This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about the school district redistricting process. It's been 5 years since Unit 5 schools saw redistricting. Superintendent Mark Daniels says it's time to start the process again.
When you have capacity issues, you better address those and better lay it out on the table.
Daniel goes in depth on redistricting during an interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Willis Kern talks with an Illinois State University graduate who helped build a modest Illinois company into a wide leader in the household product dispenser industry. Steve Hagee was the keynote speaker at ISU's Business Week. And Bloomington Alderman Amelia Burgess talks about the budget and the Metro Zone. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's February 28th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington aldermen received their first look at the budget last night. It's a 3% increase, but represents no tax or fee increases. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. And setting in for Mayor Renner is Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Burgess. Thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas, Amelia.
Thank you for having me.
The council has been considering city needs and expenses for a while, with the capital improvement plan presentations dating back to streets and sidewalks in late September. How are these presentations informing you as an alderman as you consider the budget?
These presentations really help give us a big picture grasp of what the issues are. And until we can understand what it is that is not being done, what we need to do, we can't plan to make it happen. And those have been essential in moving forward and accomplishing those goals that we have, which is a safer community and a community with an updated infrastructure.
And a five-year outlook as well, not a year-to-year.
Yes. And that is essential not only toward achieving our goals in terms of infrastructure and public improvement, but also in beginning to really develop that sustainable budget, where we're not talking every year about cuts, we're not talking about impending financial issues, but we have a grasp on it, and we can reliably repeat a balanced budget.
This was the first public presentation of the budget last night, sort of a first draft. Is that one way to look at it, a 600-page first draft?
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. Yes, it's two booklets, it's 600 pages, but while it is the draft proposed budget, it is the reflection of many, many months of interaction with the finance department, which has done an extensive amount of work, reaching out to council, talking with council, getting our priorities, working with department heads to look at where cuts can be made, where we need to expand in our services. So this really does reflect an ongoing process.
So more drilling down is still ahead, though.
Yes, we will continue to look at this draft budget. At this point, though, if we've all done our jobs, we shouldn't see any dramatic changes.
There's a comprehensive review of the CIP on March 20th and a public hearing on the budget on March 27th. So the CIP will continue to play a role as decisions are made or as aldermen drill down into the budget?
Yes, of course it will. But the CIP is more of that long-term planning, whereas the budget is the year-to-year planning.
Sure. Assessed valuation is up, bringing more money to city coffers. There's the sales tax that was approved last year. That's additional money. Also additional money from ending the Metro Zone agreement, which we'll touch on in a moment. But in the summer of 2015, the city was working through some difficult budget decisions, including streamlining bulky and solid waste and talking about what's charged for those services. There were discussions about maybe closing a golf course. Also, even at the micro level with the police buyback, which only totals about $160,000. Those talks have sort of disappeared. Is the city doing enough to hold the line on expenses, do you think?
Well, the budget task force that I was able to participate in was a very intensive process where we looked at everything. And the message that was very clear to me from that process was that there is no pool of money that exists that can quickly and easily be cut to solve all our problems. And so we couldn't, at the end of the budget task force, just find a way to say this cut will do it. And part of that is because, with the, you know, for example, the golf courses, there are many people who use that amenity, like it, and want to pay for it. So what we instead have been focusing on is more of what you I think you referred to as the micro-level cuts, saying that there is no single large pool of money that can be cut, but we're looking at many incremental cuts that can be made. This proposed budget for fiscal year 2018 actually includes $2.7 million in departmental cuts. And those are things only the department heads could have looked at, because they know their departments best. They can look at that and say, where can we economize? And clearly, they've been very successful in doing that.
Do you have a for instance at your fingertips?
Yes, I think well, so. I have extensive notes
sure.
at this point trying to
That's
keep
fine.
It all
While you look mm-hmm. at that, let me ask another question. What happens between now and May 1st as it concerns the budget?
Between now and May 1st, Council will have a full-day budget workshop where we sit down and really look at the details and can understand what those impacts are. So, if, for example, those departmental cuts, we will discuss those in more detail to find out what that will mean for services. But we're not expecting any cuts there. We're just expecting greater efficiencies or elimination of redundancies, those kinds of activities. But we'll hear from all of the department heads. They'll explain to us what it is that is contained in the budget, what they hope to achieve, and what we can expect in the next year.
During the mayoral campaign, we heard from more than one candidate that the economy is in recession or the taxing policies of the city is causing businesses to leave or have problems. What does this budget say about that, do you think?
This budget takes some of those concerns into account. One thing we have noticed is while our economy generally is strong, we're seeing, as you mentioned, the EAV has increased. We're seeing new development, new buildings going up in the city. We are seeing relatively flat growth on our sales tax, and that is concerning. That's a significant source of revenue for us. And that's why when you look at this draft budget, you will see a couple of different numbers in terms of what the budget impact is. Overall, the budget grows at 3%. All right. But the reason the budget is growing is that we are spending money, so we will be spending more because we've been saving money for some large infrastructure projects. This particular budget includes $24 million for infrastructure budgets in the next fiscal year. But if you look at our general fund, which is where you would look to see if we're really, you know, doing what we say we need to do, which is controlling costs, you will see the growth there is only at 0.61%, which is below the rate of inflation. And that is because we've had to make some very difficult cuts in those areas.
We've also heard that crime, and I'm quoting a candidate here, is out of control. What did you hear last night at the council meeting from Police Chief Hefner?
The statistics and the data do not support that. The statistics and data, looking at comparables and looking at our past history, show that the city of Bloomington is a very safe community. We continue to look for ways to improve on that, but when we compare it to other communities like size in the area, and again, when we look at past years in Bloomington, we are looking at some of the lowest crime rates in decades.
And are there areas in that crime report that worry you, though? There were some increases, upticks in some violent areas.
There were some, because we're very concerned about, and as Chief Hefner mentioned last night, it would appear that some youth are solving their issues with guns. And so we're seeing increased reports of gunfire in some of our neighborhoods. That is incredibly concerning, because while we didn't see a large number of injuries from those incidents, every time a gun is fired, that is the possibility for something very bad to happen. And so we're very much looking at ways to increase outreach and to start looking at the source of that problem and try to reduce it as much as we can.
I want to keep the interview moving here because we have limited time. We'll do the for instances on specific departmental budget cuts. We'll post those online at WGLT.org, and we'll talk about that after the interview. That's Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Burgess in the studio for Mayor Renner. You're listening to Sound Ideas. The city is now folded $1.2 million into their budget by eliminating a payment to the town of Normal by pulling out of the Metro Zone shared tax district. You voted in favor of terminating Bloomington's participation. Tell me about your thought process on this.
Sure. And this is a conversation that has been going on for a while. Obviously, this is a 30-year-old deal. And so when I came on to council 2 years ago, the conversation had already started. Is this accomplishing what we wanted to accomplish? Has it achieved its goals? Is it time to move on? And from Bloomington's perspective, it has. This was a very successful, incredibly innovative agreement at the time it was entered into. It was necessary for both communities to come together to really make that new development possible. But I think it's time to move on. I think it's time to ask the bigger question is, which is, what can we do next? What is the Metro Zone of our generation to ensure that we enjoy strong financial growth and economic security into the future?
What about the moratorium that was discussed or posited by the town of Normal, basically putting the agreement in a holding pattern, suspending payments, and then continuing to negotiate? What about that approach?
Yeah, and that just reflects two different points of view. And before today, I was trying to think about how do I summarize where we are based on the conversations that we've had, which have been extensive and varied and involving a large number of different people. But here's how I can best summarize it. My understanding is the town of Normal preferred to have discussions about what comes next before the current agreement went away, or before it went away. The city of Bloomington, on the whole, saw it differently. They said, why structure our comments based on an existing contract or an existing agreement that we don't think reflects current modern practices in this area? So let's get rid of that agreement, not be bound by it, not be restricted by it, and then have our conversations. And from my perspective, I see and understand both points of view. I don't think one is right or one is wrong. It's just a matter of which one the city of Bloomington was most comfortable in moving forward with.
The recommended motion to pull out of the metro zone called for, quote, a new process of joint collaboration between the city of Bloomington and the town of Normal on regional economic development. What do you make of that?
I think it's a great positive step forward.
What does it mean?
It means that both communities understand that we are better together, that while we are separate communities and to some extent we have separate and distinct perspectives, together, when it comes to these economic development deals, if we work together, we will do better. And that, you know, when we're talking about that, we're not talking necessarily about the businesses that are within our community. We're talking about bringing in new opportunities, you know, and what does that look like? And that's a complicated conversation.
What does cooperation look like moving forward with what seem like hard feelings on the part of the town of Normal?
Sure. And cooperation is one of those things. It requires a commitment of both communities to say we're going to cut each other a little slack. We're going to understand that we may not always agree, but that is not always a bad thing.
Mayor Coos has said this erodes trust between the two communities. Is there trust to be rebuilt?
I think there is always a need to clarify. So I think it's unfortunate that this could be perceived as something that would undermine trust. I really do, because that is not the intent of Bloomington. Bloomington's intent, like I said, is to look for something better. So I think what we need to do is have a conversation about what does collaboration look like? What does trust look like? And what are we trying to achieve together? Keeping in mind that our communities already do a lot together. We interact with a lot of programs in ways that residents don't even think about it. A simple example is when you take your library card to the Town of Normal's library and you have a Bloomington library card, you can use it. I mean, just little things like that that make life easier. But these bigger picture questions of how do we work together to encourage economic development are things that it's hard to, it's a more complicated, and there aren't a lot of good models for that. So we're really going to have to be inventive here.
It's election day. Anything you want to say about doing your civic duty in the in the city of Bloomington? You're an elected official. You were in a ward that, and you know how the turnout is in these kinds of elections.
Yeah. All I can say is our community is better when our citizens are engaged. And one of the great pleasures of being on Bloomington City's Council is interacting with residents. And today, for all the residents of Bloomington, this is one opportunity to have your voice heard. Also, just want to give a shout out to all of the poll workers out there today. They volunteer their time. They'll be there all day working hard to make sure that when you do go vote, you have a good experience.
Polls are open till 7. Do you want to make any predictions?
I think two people will move on to the general.
That's a safe prediction, Amelia. And you want to go any further than that?
I do not. Okay. I do not. I'll be anxiously awaiting the results just like everyone else.
All right. Amelia Burgess is Ward 4 Alderman in Bloomington. Thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Burgess is setting in for Mayor Renner. Next Tuesday, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Coos. The community's mayors join us following Monday evening council meetings. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. It is said, not altogether jokingly, that the only two things that are guaranteed to get a school superintendent fired is trying to kill off a school mascot and school redistricting. Unit 5 is not trying to change mascots, but it has been roughly 5 years since the district last drew new school boundaries, and Unit 5 is just starting that process again. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Unit 5 school superintendent Mark Daniel about the ticklish job of approaching this third rail of education administration.
We do have some growth areas that we're examining very closely. By growth areas, I'm talking buildings are at capacity or near capacity. So we've hired a demographer to examine our trends, population trends. Importantly, we need to know what birth rates in these particular areas, because I am talking about elementary school and I'm talking about one of our high schools. So with that said, when you have capacity issues, you better address those and better lay it out on the table and to examine. I am pleased that we now have rather sophisticated software through our student information system. We can basically do configurations and find out what the various breakdowns are. If you'd move this, if you'd do this, if you'd change that. This is one of the toughest things to do because of the emotional buy-in to that school. We do have a committee that's formed. We've met a few times. We're now waiting for the demographer study to come back, but we won't have that until after mid-April to the end of April.
Where do you suspect your highest birth rates will be?
We definitely have capacity issue, for instance, Twand Elementary School. There is no more room in that building. We've modified a cafeteria. We've changed the IMC or the library to a classroom. There is literally no more room in that facility. So we know we can handle that for next year with some of our adjustments. The other area that we're seeing would be...
Adjustments mean sending a few kids away?
Through perhaps open attendance type policy. Maybe some students would want to go to a Grove or North Point because of their proximity to that. We'd be open to that, and we'd provide transportation.
So redistricting on the retail.
Yes, exactly. And then as far as the high schools, there is a population difference between West and between community high school. About 400, 450 students. We're seeing that trend continue. One building is larger a bit by square footage.
Normal community has about seven more classrooms,
a little larger parking lot, that sort of thing. Again, you have to look at all those pieces.
But if you put 30 kids in a classroom,
that's only 210.
That's only 210.
That's
so,
right. So you do hope, and I'll also say this, you do hope that we start examining more and more opportunities for the classroom to be in the community. I.e., if you look at our entrepreneurship program, there are students right now that very rarely go into the building for two periods because they're involved in the entrepreneurship program. Their classroom is the community. I think they also have a classroom here on campus at the business center. So with that said, those things will come more and more. But meanwhile, though, we do have to think, what are we going to do with that population as well? So at the very front end and at the very tail end.
How will you manage public expectations? What will your process be to make it clear and present as few surprises to parents as possible?
As we've examined this, and fortunately we have some board members who have been part of this process, and they have gently reminded me that this is one of the most difficult processes to undergo. And so we started with a committee, and the committee consists of some parents, it consists of some teachers, it also consists of administrators and board members to start the dialogue. I'm sure we'll be going to an open format where we'll have a discussion when that does occur. Again, from a timeline perspective, you think about that, we actually start scheduling students late December, early January. If we are going to make adjustments, we need to be gathering this data to do something with it by late fall of 2017, if we're going to make changes for 18-19. Well, that is the timeline. You could also look at some other alternatives, blended classrooms. Sometimes students are there in the classroom at the desk with the teacher. But if you're blending, they're also using distance learning and they're connecting with that teacher. There are some of those possibilities that I would like to place on the table as well. But I would tell you, I am highly impressed with the quality of education in all of our schools. And I would say we're just very fortunate to have the level of quality of teaching, of programs, and so forth. So regardless of where you may be sending your student, it's interesting that every family, when they talk about their own individual school, they rate it very high. But then if they rate the whole district or the state or have you, the further you get from that building level, the less less faith, I guess you could say, they have in that school or the school system.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mark Daniel, the superintendent of Unit 5 Schools, joins us periodically for a chat about issues in education. Redistricting is not just a numbers and birth rate game. It is an ethnic and economic diversity game as well. Rightly or wrongly, the poster child for that particular flashpoint issue is Fairview Elementary and has been for decades. Mm-hmm. How do you anticipate that being addressed?
Yeah, we do have several schools that have high socioeconomic free and reduced statuses. And with that said, as we look at the elementary levels, and this is a decision that as we work with the board, what are our major parameters, major guidelines? And you're right, it's socioeconomic. So you want a balance of free and reduced. You want a balance of ethnicity. If you can do that, surely at the high school, that's a major goal. Junior high school, and very important, I believe those were the parameters that were heavily weighted in the prior redistricting. Elementary schools, we tend to believe those are neighborhood schools.
Geography.
And geography. So elementary is primarily geography, although they can be tweaked some, and that has been done. Then you move into more of the parameters that we've just mentioned in the secondary world.
Should you flip that, though, in the service of extending a diverse experience to all of the school children of the community? Should that be really flipped?
That's an interesting question. I've never thought about that. I will tell you, though, as you do enter into the secondary world, our district now is about 30% free and reduced. I don't know if the community realizes that.
As opposed to 51 to 60, depending on your building in District 87.
And depending upon your elementary schools, we may have some that are over 60, 65% free and reduced. But with that, there are also additional resources that flow into those buildings. So I guess as I'm thinking about this, where do we want to place those additional resources? More at the front end of the child's educational experience or at the end of that as far as the 11th, 12th grade experience? I'm a person who favors how can we make sure that we've jump-started each child so they have that fighting chance to be successful.
So is that an argument for maintaining schools that have a high free and reduced lunch rate because they qualify for additional federal resources rather than spreading out that population?
Well, you know, that's interesting because we do receive more federal funding if it is a Title I school. With that, though, come limitations as far as what we can do. From a federal government standpoint, when we're receiving those Title I dollars and Title II dollars and Title III dollars for our ELL population, we want to focus those programs where we can best meet the needs of that unique group. Now, if I spread that all across the district, I cannot do that with the level of fidelity and program input. It's too thin then.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mark Daniel, the superintendent of Unit 5 Schools, joins us. You do allow geographic concentrations to persist because of that, then?
The way the system, and it's interesting because we know we have a particular population of students, second language, or ELL population, in some key areas of our community. They tend to go to one elementary school. With that then comes additional resources for those students. If I would spread them all out, I wouldn't be able to have quite the program. I wouldn't have the program that we have right now for those students.
While it is true that families with lower incomes are also more likely to face transportation barriers, so if you do try to split up the geographic organization of elementary schools, you run into that issue.
Right.
Do they not benefit disproportionately from being in a learning environment where other kids have expectations and have cultures that prize learning and are familiar with it and where there is family support?
I think they would as well. There's no doubt. As we've looked at our elementary program, those students who come to that kindergarten classroom having daycare versus students who don't have daycare, there's a noticeable difference in both behavior as well as knowledge level and understanding.
So not that this is an easy question. But
it's not an easy one. It's very difficult.
Which do you believe is more important? And if there is a controlling factor, which is it? environment, a diverse environment with lots of different cultures of learning, or the extra aid that comes with a high poverty rate school?
I would say from the standpoint of the level of needs that we're seeing in some of our schools, that we need those additional resources. We have to have those additional resources. There are schools, and we hear it throughout the community, and truly this isn't just a socioeconomic issue, but there are schools where we have special programming for specific behavior, that if we don't have those resources in that area, I would think that we would be disservicing our total population, because some of those behaviors, a general ed teacher could not function as well, unlike a special education teacher has that training, has those various methods of instruction and so forth. So from that standpoint, now I've sort of gone mental health on you a little bit. We've literally designed our elementary programs, our secondary programs, to house certain programs in certain buildings. And again, that's to best use the resource. Now, ideally, I would love to see students where truly you have a demographic that is representative of our community, with high affluent families, with families that are of low socioeconomic background. And yes, I think there is part of that assimilation and that coming together to understand, first of all, there are some students who may never see that level of poverty, and it does open your eyes to the world. On the other hand, if I am coming from a low socioeconomic family, perhaps I've never seen this side where, what can I do? How can I really reach that American dream? How can I strive to get to that point? But again, that's a teacher working within their own classroom to create a culture that I would hope I'd walk into any classroom, that there's this culture of learning, a culture of continuous improvement, a culture of I can advance, I can do better. And I'm hoping that we're going to see that come to fruition in our society as a whole.
Unit 5 School Superintendent Mark Daniel spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlinker. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. We all want wet noses and wagging tails, but pet parents should be aware of lurking genetic issues with some of our pets. Learn more during an edition of Animal House on the way. An Illinois State University graduate who helped build a modest Illinois company into a worldwide leader in the household product dispenser industry is retiring next month. Steve Hagee was the keynote speaker at ISU's Business Week. He tells GLT's Willis Kern he was one of the first students enrolled in 1969 in the university's brand new accounting department.
So when I started, I had a good financial background coming out of high school. I wanted something in business, and to be honest with you, at the time, I really didn't know all what accounting was. But I thought it was a good try, came back and was reasonably successful, and as I went through school with a lot of help from the professors that I had, determined I would start my career on the accounting side.
And who were your professors and your mentors, and what did they teach you?
Well, again, the one that had the most influence on me was a gentleman by the name of Max Rexroad. Max has been at Illinois State for a lot of years. Max was a new professor when I saw him. Jim Hallam was the head of the department. We had a lot of different people come back and help me go through the program. And what I think that is for us, and both my wife and I, if we've gone through Illinois State, what was impressive was not just the level of education, because all of these people were very good in knowledge base, but the level of engagement they had with me as an individual and my wife as an individual. So that has been something that has stuck with both of us for all these years past.
Did you feel like they had a connection to the industry so that the things you were learning mattered and were relevant?
You know, I think that became more relevant to me after I got out of school, because going into it, I'd like to tell you I had a great vision of what I was going to do. What they did is they brought a great base for me to go forward with and gave me a lot of great references of what they saw on the outside.
So the relevancy and the attention was there during your education. You just didn't realize it until later on, right?
And I think that's a lot of times in education what happens is if you, you know, given that age, it really has more of an impact as you can build on those references as you go out into the working world. And for me, it fostered for me something that I don't even know that they knew was a great curiosity about doing business internationally, not just doing business in the United States. And for me, that's had a big impact on my career.
Besides that bachelor's degree that you obviously took to your first job outside of Illinois State, what was your biggest takeaway from your collegiate experience?
Well, I mean, the biggest takeaway was I met my wife the first day here and got married the last day here. So that's probably been my biggest takeaway.
Well, it sure sounds like it.
Well, you know, I told her she's still in training, so we still have her on a training program. No, but seriously, I think what we came back to was a lot of good people that we met, not only in the faculty, but close friends that we've been able to stay in touch with. Some of the best friends we have are coming back from the university setting.
Now, you've been at Aptar Group for 35 years. This is a Crystal Lake firm that provides dispensing and sealing solutions for a wide variety of fragrance, personal care, household, food, beverage, and pharmaceutical products. Your customers include Procter & Gamble, Kraft Heinz, Pepsi, L'Oreal, Estee Lauder, and many, many more. So dispensing and sealing solutions, what are we talking about?
Well, again, I think if you think of containers, what we do is we get product out of containers. So we don't provide the container itself. We provide either aerosol valve mechanisms, which take product out of pressurized containers, pump products that take them for fragrances, et cetera, out of non-pressurized, closures, which have either a flip-top cap where you don't have to unscrew. So again, it makes it easier to get out. And then we do a lot of injectable areas. So we're one of those companies that you may not know our name, but you probably use 5 to 10 of our products maybe today, and certainly you got 5 to 10 in your home.
What's been the greatest accomplishment of your company? Maybe another way of saying that is, what have you seen, how have you seen the best growth or the greatest growth from when you joined the company until today?
Well, to give some reference to the people that don't know Aptar, when I started back in 1981, Aptar was about $40 million in revenue. Today, Aptar is a $2.3 billion revenue company. It's traded on the New York Stock Exchange with a market capitalization of about $4.7 billion. So it's had significant growth over the period. I think what we've been able to do is we've been very successful in adapting to the market. As markets have changed, we've adapted. We've grown worldwide. So when I joined the business, 50% of Aptar's revenue back in 1981 was generated outside the United States. So today, almost 73% is generated outside the U.S. So I think we've been able to grow. We've been able to convert people to more convenient ways of dispensing. And I think that's been the biggest accomplishment. The other thing is, if in our pharmaceutical business, which is a major part of our business, we're providing a lot of what I call life-saving technologies to really impact people's health, but in the asthma area, allergy area, and other different medicines as we see going through.
So you started with the company in 1981, and here 35 years later, you're the CEO and on the board of directors. Tell us about your climb through the company. How did that happen?
Well, again, when I started with the business, it's around $40 million. I came into a finance function up in Cary, Illinois, which is one of our facilities. And from there, within about a year, I ended up going back to having overall responsibility for Aptar's finance worldwide. The nice thing about being with a company the size and being very entrepreneurial, extremely value-based, is that I was able to do a lot of different things throughout my career. So I stayed in the finance. I did a lot of things in the operating area, managing certain of our businesses. 1993, Aptar became public. I became the chief financial officer of the company, so I was in that role as a new publicly held business, being able to deal with the external financial markets. And then as we continued to grow, I became chief operating officer, and then finally chief executive officer.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kernan. We're visiting with Stephen Hagee, CEO of Aptar Group, based in Crystal Lake. He was the keynote speaker at this year's Business Week activities at his alma mater, Illinois State University. You're also the head of your company's charitable foundation. Which organizations benefit from Aptar's profitability, and how is that determined?
In terms of the charitable foundation, it is U.S. specific. And what we've tried to do is we try to take functions rather than what I would consider to be very broad national efforts, but rather to try to take those to charities that impact our employees, whether that's in the Chicago area, Milwaukee area, Stamford, Connecticut area, a lot of different areas around the country. We try to end up coming back and looking both cultural, the humanities. We do a lot of work with battered women. We do a lot of work in terms of food care for the hungry. We want people to be engaged not only in terms of the finances we give, but also the interactivity of the personal time that they spend with those organizations.
You are also on the board for CF Industries. This is a fertilizer manufacturing and distribution firm. What do you bring to this company to help it be one of the top firms of its kind in the nation?
You know, I think there's a couple skill sets when I went on the board. So I went on that board in 2010. I think they were looking at that time for someone who had dealt with an international company. CF today is heavily U.S.-based and was looking to get more international. So I brought some skill sets to that. And secondly, I brought some financial skill sets in terms of my background with Aptar. And last, I think in a very key part of any board that I've been associated with is I think the ability to deal in a board setting. How do you come back and deal collegially with very smart people to make hopefully the best decisions for the company?
So how do you do that? Maybe you're talking to aspiring students who someday will want to themselves aspire to that sort of position. What are the key things you have to watch out for in order to be effective in that role?
I think one of the key things that at least my learning has been is you need to listen. You need to listen. You need to come back and try to take other people's opinions, and then try to come back and see how those opinions either differ or are the same as yours. And at that point, try to come to consensus. I think board is not very much different than how Aptar runs our business. We're much more of a consensual decision-making company rather than authoritarian. So I think when you come back to board, and I also think this is true in nonprofit boards, is how do you engage and how do you also not only listen but engage your other directors to try to get the best of what they can bring to that board, again, to get the best solution for either the company and or the association that you're dealing with.
What do you think has been the biggest thing the business world has had to adapt to over the 35 years that you've been at this organization anyway?
I think the world continues to get smaller. Used to be that you can operate, I remember in 1973, my international experience was Chicago. Today, I don't care if you're running a small business in Normal, Illinois, you have the ability to touch places all over the world. So I think the world has gotten smaller. I keep encouraging our children to have a natural curiosity about different cultures. I think it is a lot of fun. But I think it's almost a necessity in today's business. So I think that world has gotten smaller. And the other side is the ability to adapt your business to very fast changing conditions. The world was easier to deal with, frankly, 30 years ago. We needed to adapt the Aptar business model quicker today than we've ever done in the past.
I had guessed that you'd probably say globalization was probably the biggest change. So I'm going to continue guessing here that maybe technology and government affairs, being able to operate in an environment that government sets the rules, I suppose those are a couple other key areas too.
Certainly technology for us has been an issue in enabling us to get better information. Government affairs we deal with much more indirectly. So I would, for our business, it tends to be much more how is taxation going to affect us, where we're looking to set up operations, where we don't. But it is less of a direct impact on our business. Now, the one offset to that would be in our pharmaceutical business, new regulations, whether it's with the FDA or other regulatory associations around the world. That does impact our business, and we need to make sure our research and development spend incorporates those new regulations and how we look at new products.
You spoke to a group of senior business majors and other business students at Illinois State University and possibly elsewhere. What do you tell these people?
You know, I think it's the same things that we've talked about. I think when you come back is it's a small world. If you can try to think broader than what you're living in today. So think on a worldwide basis. Have curiosity about it. Be diverse in your thought process. Be adaptable. Come back. Recognize that there are cultural differences. I recognized very early on that the German and the French, it's a very interesting side how you work with those different nationalities. But frankly, I think that's a lot of fun.
Steve Hagee speaking with GLT's Willis Kern. Hagee is CEO of Aptar Group, a $2.3 billion revenue company based in Crystal Lake. He was the keynote speaker during Business Week activities at his alma mater, Illinois State University. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. When we get a new dog, they come preloaded with fur, tail wags, and lots of love. And sometimes they can bring along certain genetic problems that we as pet parents need to be aware of. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of GLT's Animal House.
When your pet carries a gene that can turn into a potential health problem, you've got to focus on long-term management rather than short-term control. A recent edition of Clinician's Brief for Doctors of Veterinary Medicine digs into the top five genetic diseases for dogs and how to best treat them. Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal says starting out at number five is a problem that might take you by surprise because Fraker says most people don't think of this as a genetic disease.
Cranial cruciate ligament rupture, which is the equivalent of an anterior cruciate ligament rupture in humans, ACL in humans, CCL in dogs. Because so many ACLs in humans are traumatic, skiing, football, basketball, running, there's always been this assumption that that's the same thing that's going on with dogs, that these are athletic dogs, highly mobile, and they hit something wrong and this traumatic event occurs. And in fact, we're fairly certain it's a genetic predisposition with conformation in the knee. A lot of these dogs who have been athletic 3, 4, 5 years old, and you get in on their knee as soon as they rupture their cruciate, and you find really a surprising amount of arthritis in the knee for such a young animal. And the thought process is that there's conformational defects in these dogs that lead to a low, kind of chronic low-grade arthritis that's totally subclinical. The owners don't know it's there, the dogs never show signs, but that low-grade arthritic inflammation is weakening the cruciate ligament and makes it easy to pop. And the other thing you'll see is these dogs who have had one cruciate go, most of those dogs are going to experience the other leg rupturing in a 2 to 3 year span.
Was there anything we can do to prevent this?
This one's a tough one because the conformation, figuring out who has this and how it shows up, it's really difficult. The big thing is managing it. Once it happens, is figuring out the appropriate management. That's controversial right now.
What is it?
Well, it's always been considered surgical, especially for animals 20, 25 pounds or heavier. Like cats rupturing their cruciates, not a whole lot of surgery, at least in our clinic. We don't often push surgery too hard on cats or small dogs. But the bigger animals and the really big animals, surgery is still probably the top recommendation. But there have been some studies out there looking at dogs' recovery rates without surgery. Now, this becomes very complicated because if it's just a cruciate rupture and the meniscus doesn't get torn, the problem is when the cruciate tears, the tibia becomes unstable in a front-back motion. So you can actually slip the tibia out in front of the leg, and it's called a drawer. In humans, it's the same way. It's a cranial drawer, an anterior drawer. Well, that drawer instability means that your cups, your little meniscal cups, are getting dragged back and forth by the end of the femur, and it's not uncommon for the middle meniscus to get a bucket handle tear with that distraction back and forth. Now, meniscal tear is a surgical situation. That's going to cause the animal lots of discomfort until you get in there and clean that up. I still feel that on the bigger animals, you want to certainly consider surgery. There's a couple different surgeries out there. This is also controversial. Which one is better? Many studies show them kind of head-to-head. That's all discussions to have with your veterinarian. But generally, think about surgery on a cruciate.
All right. What is the top four genetic disease for dogs?
Number four, we have to have a really cool name for it. We don't usually call it this in practice. Myxomatous mitral valve disease.
That's cool.
It's myxomatous. What a great word. And it is clean, WGLT. It's okay. You don't have to edit it.
Okay, great.
So heart disease, mostly small dogs, Cavalier, King Charles Spaniels, are well known for having this. I think we see it a lot more often in small dogs where they'll develop a murmur anywhere from 7 to 11, 7, 12, 13 years old. They start getting a heart murmur. And what's happening there is we're getting these fibrous changes on their tricuspid valve, so the valve doesn't close all the way and you get a little regurge. Now, many dogs can handle that and compensate for that for years. So a dog with a heart murmur doesn't necessarily need to be managed with drugs right away.
Well, I would think diet would help. I mean, having too much weight would make things work.
There's common sense stuff to avoid obesity in these animals. Dogs have classic signs for heart failure where they start doing a dry hacking cough, sometimes increased respirations with the mouth closed. Panting is not typically a symptom of heart failure.
Huh.
Resting dogs, where you can see their ribs, they look like they're breathing with a little bit more effort. In, out, and again with the dry cough. And they usually give us some time to institute medical therapy, and it is very effective in dogs. It can really make a difference on their lifespan. So with these little dogs that develop murmurs, the big thing is to continue to monitor them. Anytime that you have to go see your vet, if it's a nail trim or a bump or itchy, have them check the heart, make sure there's no clinical signs associated with the heart. If you start thinking that you're having clinical signs with the heart, then you do the standard stuff, EKGs, chest x-rays, consider some medical management for those guys.
How about number three?
Number three, I think this is interesting that they have this on the list. It's because of breed popularity. If we manage certain breeds, which I wouldn't recommend because I love these breeds also, but it's the brachycephalic obstructive airway syndrome.
Are we talking a smash-faced?
Smash-faced dogs,
yes,
absolutely.
Like a pug.
Bulldogs, French bulldogs, and pugs are the main ones that come
They're
to mind.
They're very popular right
they
now.
They are hugely popular. Now, here's my take on that. Every one of those breeds should be hugely popular. Pugs, Frenchies, and English bulldogs are great dogs. All breeds are great dogs. Those are all great dogs. The architecture in bulldogs and pugs, when you go into the back of their throat, their palates are too long. They're these meaty, soft palates that can actually fall like a curtain down into the airway when they're breathing in. When they start really getting stressed out, this flabby, soft palate can get sucked in. And they have other architectural changes we don't too technical to go into here that contribute even further to the blocking of this airway. And it can be extremely serious. Now, there's really, really solid surgical management to repair all of these architectural abnormalities in the backs of their throats. It's expensive. In my personal opinion, the docs who do this a lot do it, and they're great, and I would recommend it because it's not the kind of surgery that I think you want someone, I've always wanted to try this.
Go to somebody who knows their chops.
Yes, I would. We'll see some animals that when they get older, they're obese, they're old, that the owners are very uncomfortable with the thought of subject them to anesthesia, and legitimately so. So there's some things we can do medically to take some of the stress off all that tissue in the back of the throat.
All right, what's number two?
Number two, everyone knows, canine hip dysplasia.
Oh, dear.
It can affect just about anybody. Certainly, certain dogs are more prone to it. German Shepherds, we know. The Orthopedic Foundation of Animals has a screening x-rays. They recommend at 2 years of age.
Dogs, a screening x-ray?
Well, for dogs, absolutely for breeders. And absolutely if you've spent a lot of money on what your purebred retriever or lab or shepherd, and you just want to get in. Most of the really good breeders have some sort of dysplasia guarantee and have tried very hard to get the dysplasia out of their population. A good time to confirm that's at 2 years. The bones are developed, pretty much structured where they're going to be. You can do 6 months, 7 months, 9 months, but there's still a lot of things that are going to change. And a lot of younger dogs have x-rays where they look like they're dysplastic, there's distraction and whatnot, and it's an artifact. It's not actual dysplasia.
Okay, so let's say you get the screening done and it looks like, yeah, dysplasia is going to be a serious issue ahead for my pet. What can I do?
We've discussed several times nutrition. People underestimate the importance of trim dogs with arthritis. So, yes, we have anti-inflammatories we can use. Yes, we have joint supplements we can use. Great joint supplements out there.
Hydrotherapy.
Swimming your dog, using the tanks that they have the treadmills in. All of those things are maybe, let's say, 20% of what you can do for this animal. You're working with this little 20% work zone of improving their comfort and their function. Weight loss is like 80% of it. All of my dogs, I always keep them on a J.D. Hill's diet. It's a joint protective diet made for arthritis, but it's so packed with fatty acids and joint supplements that I just think it's a great diet, period. So I put all of my dogs on that. And joint supplements on big dogs, whether they have arthritis or not, be proactive because their joints are getting beat up. If these dogs are 80 pounds or bigger, healthy, muscular, whatever, their joints are getting beat up and they're trying to get arthritis into their older years. So there's no harm in being proactive with fatty acid supplementation and joint supplementation. Ultimately, there is a surgery called a femoral head osteotomy where we just go in and we remove the femoral head. So we get rid of the femur acetabulum of the pelvis, that contact. It's not a hip replacement. It's just taking away with all the points of contact. And the hip muscles actually make that joint work. So you do not handicap a dog by doing this. The function can be excellent, especially with the loss of pain that is created by the surgery.
Okay, and let's go to number one, genetic disease for dog.
So we in the veterinary community don't like certain diseases.
Well,
even
I would
though,
have bet.
Well, you know,
are there
it was
some
like,
you do like?
Well, the thought process being you have to love allergic dogs because you make so much money off allergic dogs. And it's just like, you know, it's not worth it. I like to earn my money. There's other ways
the
that's
honest
fun.
Way.
Yeah, you know, saving a dog's life from with a cancer surgery or something exciting like that. Knowing when your dog shows up at 6 months of age or 2 years of age scratching and allergic and it's not fleas and it's not something we can just easily put our finger on. We know we're going to get to know you so well, and you're going to hate us by about 3 or 4 years of seeing us 2 or 3 times a year. So allergic skin disease is number one, and it's out there in many forms and fashions. We have allergic skin disease secondary to food, which is one of the more frustrating ones to diagnose. But the good news is if you go through all the efforts of diagnose food-related allergic skin disease, you're going to cure your allergy. There's also environmental allergies, and those are seasonal. There's spring kind of into summer. There's summer sort of into fall, and then there's winter. Environmental allergies. The gold standard for figuring out allergy in dogs is flea protection year-round, really good flea product, flea protection, doing diet trials, which are very frustrating, and ultimately possibly going to a dermatology referral center and getting a skin test. And even when we find out, we've had dogs test and they were just raging with all seasonal allergies. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is going to be so miserable. You can try to desensitize with injections like they do with children. But a lot of these animals end up having to be managed chronically for their breakouts using some sort of anti-inflammatories, whether it's antihistamines in mild cases. Steroids are often incorporated and when used judiciously are highly effective with allergy management.
That's Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. If adding a new dog to your life is currently on your agenda, you might want to consider Becca, the Animal House Pet of the Week. Becca is a 4-year-old mix, part border collie, part pit bull. This happy girl loves interacting with people, and she loves the snacks. Lots and lots of snacks. So Becca's looking for a pet parent willing to dole out love, hugs, and long walks rather than handfuls of treats. You can find Becca at the Humane Society of Central Illinois. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Send your pet-related question to one of our Animal House team of experts at WGLT.org. Find Animal House and the rest of today's show at WGLT.org. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Go to Twitter, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News.